Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, House Speaker Greg Hughes announces that he won't seek re-election this year, stoking speculation that he will run for governor in 2020. Also, the growing evidence that air pollution, even in lower amounts, can be deadly. And an effort by State Representative Mike Noel to strip cities of their ability to regulate their own watersheds and what that might mean for development in northern Utah canyons. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Lee Davidson is with us. Lee, welcome back.
Thank you.
Tribune public lands reporter Brian Maffley, welcome to you. Good morning.
Yeah, hey, thanks, Roger.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh is here as well. Good morning, Paul. Welcome.
Good morning.
As always, we want to hear from our listeners. If you've got questions or comments about any of the stories that we are covering today, you can call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK, or post your questions at sltrib.com. Lee Davidson, let's begin with some politics news. Utah House Speaker Greg Hughes told his colleagues this week that he will not run for re-election this year. Tell us what Speaker Hughes said and what reasons he gave for this decision.
Sure. He's not running for two things. He's not going to seek re-election for Speaker, nor will he seek re-election to his House seat.
Okay.
He's been in the House for 16 years, and this is his last year in his second term as House Speaker. Traditionally, House Speakers only serve two terms. There's been one exception to that. Marty Stevens, years ago, ran for three terms, but it was controversial even then, and it took multiple ballots for him to win, and he won by one vote. So the fact that he was seeking re-election as Speaker may not be that big a surprise,
right.
But his timing was a surprise, caught a lot of people off guard. He announced it at an all-day caucus that House Republicans were having to plan this year's session. And he mentioned the two-year traditional limit as one reason and said he never expected to serve as long as he has and thinks, you know, they have a deep bench and it's time for others to lead.
He announced that he's also not running for re-election, as you said, as for the House of Representatives. But he did leave the door open for future political engagement, didn't he?
Yes, he left it wide open. Everyone was asking him what his plans are, and he says, "Oh well, I don't want to measure for drapes for another office now while I'm still in power. But, you know, I'm not going to rule out anything." And he says, "I love the political arena. I want to be active, and I think I will be active." And the reporters asked him, "Well, are you looking at governor? Are you looking at Congress?" And then he made comments that suggested governor. He said, "You know, working at the state level, you can get a lot done. You can move from idea to solution in a collaborative way here. In Washington, it's hard. You know, things are divided. Washington doesn't work very well," which would seem to suggest he's looking at governor. He's been mentioned for governor for a long time. Others have been too. Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox has said he's looking at it. And actually, polls say perhaps the leader is former Congressman Jason Chaffetz, who has also said that he, you know, considers that a possibility.
He also has a cozy, this is Speaker Hughes, has a cozy relationship with the Trump administration. His name was floated even for the transportation secretary position at one point, but not necessarily by the president himself. Could he go that route, or I guess did he give any signals that he might consider service at the national level despite that reticence?
You know, he was asked about that, and he says there have been no offers. But then again, he said, "Gee, there's great communication with the Trump administration," and he was an early supporter of Trump. When Trump was here recently, he referred to Hughes as the original, kind of the original supporter in the state, which Hughes brought up and mentioned, and. So it's a possibility.
Okay. I want to remind our listeners that you can join this conversation. Again, the number is 801-355-8255. Paul Raleigh, I need to remind listeners that you are a columnist free to opine on the news, unlike reporters like Lee. That out of the way, what do you think of the speaker's announcement and what it might portend for the future, what he might do next?
Well, you heard it here first. He's going to run for governor in 2020. I'll just lay it out. That's what he's going to do. And his decision to not run again and step down as speaker is an interesting strategy. And he's not the first House Speaker to want to run for governor and then figure out how you know, what to do with his House leadership seat in order to do that. Lee mentioned Marty Stevens. Well, Marty Stevens had a problem in 2000. It was 2002 when he was up for a third term. He had he'd wanted to run for Speaker when Mel Brown was Speaker, and Mel Brown was running for a third term, and Marty Stevens made a big deal about the fact that there was a tradition that you never went for three terms. Well, then Marty became Speaker, and he was in two terms. There was a two-year gap between if he was going to step down after two terms before he could run for governor, and I think he wanted to run for governor, you know, while he was still in the news a lot, and so. But he had that problem because he was the one, more than anybody else, who said that nobody should run for a third term. So what he did was he got his supporters to send a draft Marty letter around the House of Representatives to urge him, you know, to run for for a third term as Speaker. Of course, these people are signing these petitions. They need Marty Stevens, you know, to get their agendas through, their bills passed. So Marty reluctantly ran for a third term because he was drafted by his membership. But then later on, you had Becky Lockhart, who had served two terms as Speaker, and everybody knew she was going to run for governor. Unfortunately, she passed away before she had a chance to do that. But she made the decision to leave the House for 2 years before she ran for governor, just as Greg Hughes is doing now.
Well, part of that, and Lee, you can write about this or talk about this, has to do with fundraising. Speaker Hughes can't really fundraise for a potential gubernatorial run if he's still in office, if he doesn't put that kind of gap between his speakership.
Well, he can't do it during the legislature.
Okay.
Yeah, while the legislature's meeting, you can't raise funds. Yeah. Okay. But he could. He has about $72,000 in the bank, which isn't a great amount, but it's a nice head start if he decides to use it for a governor's race. Also, you know, many House speakers have tried to run for governor. Only one has pulled it off, former Governor Norm Bangerter. You know, if he were in office, he would be expected to try to help the Bangerter administration, which includes Lieutenant Governor Cox. Since those two would be running against each other, you know, that would be difficult. By stepping away, you know, he could attack the administration a little bit if he wanted to, a little bit more easily, and perhaps raise money a little bit more easily.
Less of a conflict there. Well, I guess we'll see what he does next. It seems like we're always waiting on Utah political figures to determine what they're going to do next, seeing if Romney's going to get into the Senate race. And now whether or not Speaker Hughes is going to run for governor, we can get this out of the way. We know that he's not going to run for Senator Hatch's Senate seat.
Right, which is up this year. And he threw his support to Mitt Romney, saying he highly, you know, admires Governor Romney and thinks he would be a great senator.
Okay. Lee, you also wrote about some of the priorities that Representative Hughes has for this upcoming session. It's his last session, you know, going out with a bang. What does he want to tackle?
Well, he said he wants Utah to address issues of growth, such as how to handle education better, transportation, water systems, et cetera. He said that may include tax increases. Mm-hmm. Some people think Utah will have a windfall because of the way the federal government changed its tax system. Hughes is one of those. He said we could have a tax fall of between $75 and $150 million if Utah doesn't change its current income tax system. The Utah system is based on the federal system so that you don't have to do a whole lot of recalculations when you fill out your income tax forms. Unless Utah changes that, he sees this big windfall, and he suggested keeping at least part of it to address those issues. However, others think that there is not going to be a windfall, including Senate President Wayne Niederhauser and some members of the State Tax Commission. They say it's too early to know. They just don't know.
Why is there that disconnect on what lawmakers believe will happen with taxes? Why are Hughes and Niederhauser so far apart if, you know, expected windfall or no windfall whatsoever?
They say state officials are still trying to figure it out, that federal changes are so recent that they're still running numbers. And some early numbers indicated the windfall, and they say the most recent, not so much. So,
How and when can we get clarity on the tax question, on that windfall question? Will we know during the session, for example?
Well, Niederhauser said probably within 2 weeks they would have a firm number. Some members of the State Tax Commission have said the same thing. Interestingly, John Valentine, who's the chairman of the State Tax Commission, released some numbers on what he thinks it will do to individuals, for example. He thinks middle income will pay more, low income will pay a little bit more, and high income pay the same, unless the legislature decides to change Utah's tax system.
That kind of mirrors what's happening at the federal level, if I'm reading the news correctly.
And I'm talking about how it affects their state income tax,
right,
and not just their federal income tax.
Sure. And then, meanwhile, there is talk of raising the gas tax and forcing electric vehicle owners to pay bigger fees. They don't pay the gas tax.
Yeah, there are several other tax options
sure.
out there. Niederhauser is one who's saying we should really raise the gas tax. He says that forces people who use the roads to pay for them. It was raised a few years ago by Nicola Gallen, and they put in an automatic provision that as gas prices go up, the tax would go up. But gas prices have stayed low, so they haven't received that extra money. Part of the problem is alternative fuel vehicles, like electric vehicles, totally escape the gas tax, and other vehicles get better gas mileage, so they don't pay as much gas tax either.
Right.
He said we need to raise money to pay for roads, and so we should really look at this. He has another interesting idea out there. He wants to make some changes to make it easier to expand toll roads in the state. He especially wants toll roads in Little Cottonwood Canyon in his district and in Big Cottonwood Canyon. He says they're too congested. This would cut down on congestion. And, you know, as the state grows and needs more money for transportation, he sees more toll roads in its future.
I want to circle back just to the idea that Speaker Hughes might run for governor and turn it back to Paul Raleigh. We have just a couple of minutes before we go to our first break of the show. But are there, you know, big stumbling blocks, Paul Raleigh, that would get in the way of Speaker Hughes becoming governor? I mean, is that too speculative a question, actually? It seems like he's a very well-known name here. But Spencer Cox could be a potential...
Well,
battle for him.
Speaker Hughes and Governor Herbert's administration, they've bumped heads a few times. They've had, Speaker Hughes is basically took the lead on the homeless issue in Salt Lake City, and it actually brought up a lot of questions about where's Governor Herbert, you know, and where's this been, my sources tell me that Herbert was not pleased about that. And felt that Hughes was getting too much publicity. I'm pretty sure that Spencer Cox will run too. And so, you know, you're going to have this. Hughes won't be in the legislature the 2 years before the 2020 gubernatorial race. But he'll be out. You know, he'll be in the news. He'll you know. And as far as Jason Chaffetz is concerned, I think the reason that he was
another potential governor.
Yeah, I think the reason that he was leading in the early polls that we had was nothing more than name ID. Mm-hmm. I really believe that Hughes and Cox would be the two who would emerge. There's another name out there that's a possibility, and that's Josh Romney. But if his father is a U.S. senator, I don't know how that would fly.
That'd be interesting. I don't know it'd be another bit of trivia. When was the last time you had a senator who was whose son was the governor of the state of any state? A lot of big names, though. I mean, those are big names: Romney, Hughes, Cox, and Chaffetz. I mean, those would be it'd be a heck of a race, I guess. Lee, you're going to be up at the legislative session, which starts in about 10 days. You're moving into the Capitol then, and I'm sure you'll keep following taxes and everything else that's happening up there. But thank you very much for your reporting on this. We actually need to head to our first break of the show. When we return, we will look at some new research on air pollution that is concerning to some physicians here in Utah. That's coming up in just a minute. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more of our in-house podcasts, visit kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune environment reporter Emma Penrod, Public Lands reporter Brian Maffley, government reporter Lee Davidson, and columnist Paul Raleigh. It is our Friday morning news wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or posting them at sltrib.com. Environment reporter Emma Penrod, good morning and welcome.
Morning.
A story that you covered this week has to do with a recent study from Harvard University having to do with air pollution, particulate air pollution. Some, I guess you might say, troubling findings. Tell us about this research and what it found, Emma.
Yeah, so these researchers at Harvard, they're data scientists. And so what they did was they took a bunch of data on death rates among people 65 and older, and they compared those rates of death to air pollution data that they had access to see if there was a correlation between there being particulate matter in the air and, you know, an increase in the number of people who were dying. And they did find that there was a small but still what they would call statistically significant increase in the number of people who died after any kind of a pollution episode, including, you know, increases in pollution that even here in Utah we would consider to be, you know, green air days, that they'd be, you know, good air days we wouldn't worry about.
Hmm. And again, this is the kind of pollution that we get. I mean, we're talking about particulate PM 2.5 pollution that we get during our inversions.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, the levels that we get here are pretty regularly not safe by EPA standards. The fact that it's, you know, during green days when there's any particulate pollution whatsoever that is affecting these health outcomes, these mortalities, people are dying because of it. Was that surprising to the researchers?
Well, it has led the researchers to argue that the EPA's current levels that they regulate at, the point at which the EPA considers it not safe and therefore, you know, something that the states have to address, these researchers are now arguing that those levels are too high and that the EPA should decrease the level of allowable particulate pollution.
The lead researcher in this Harvard study, or one of the researchers in this Harvard study, said told you that there's essentially no safe level of particulate air pollution. Is that right?
Yeah, she said that she had been unable to find in the data any point that, you know, there was a clear delineation or clear point at which it was like this was the safe level and this was not the safe level. Other researchers and physicians have told me similar, that as they continue to research this pollution, they still haven't been able to find a level at which it doesn't have some form of a health effect on the people who are exposed to it.
This researcher, again, says that we should be pushing, or that lawmakers or policymakers should be pushing for the total elimination of particulate pollution, which sounds like a daunting task, but, you know, we've gone to the moon. I guess in the meantime, Emma, what can residents do to kind of protect themselves from air pollution?
Well, generally speaking, and the research, the Harvard study was looking, of course, at national air pollution. And so from their perspective, you know, this is something that these particulates are released when you burn wood or other carbon products. And so, you know, they had argued that perhaps a shift toward renewable energy and away from carbon would, you know, help to eliminate this pollutant. In Utah, we do have a little bit more complex situation because we do have to deal with this chemistry of the air where pollutants that aren't necessarily typically associated with PM 2.5, you know, and particulates are formed in the air from other pollutants instead of them being just directly emitted. And so things become a little bit more sticky here in Utah.
And is that that's because of emissions from vehicles being trapped and then turning into PM 2.5?
Right, because what we have this inversion that, you know, it puts a lid basically on top of the valley so that everything that goes into the air in the valley stays there until the inversion goes away. The inversion isn't actually the pollutions. I think some people use those terms interchangeably, but the inversion just refers to the lid that happens. And then the pollution gets trapped underneath it. And for some reason that's not entirely completely understood, when you put all of these chemicals together for a long period of time in the valley here, they mix together and they form particulates, even though usually maybe they wouldn't.
You know, I'm going to turn to Paul Raleigh for just a moment, the columnist with the Tribune. And, Paul, there's no fast enough fix for people who will die because of air pollution that we live with. Are we as a society and, I guess, as a state taking this seriously enough?
Well, being in the vulnerable group that Emma mentioned, the age group, All I know is in January and February, I could literally taste the air here in Salt Lake City. And I usually have a sore throat for 2 months. And I've got a cabin in Torrey, and I've noticed that when I go down there, I sleep better. I mean, you know, but to your question, you know, I think our public officials have been slow to act. And they've done some things. You know, like I was talking to him about this yesterday, and they have done things like try to retrofit school buses and things like that. But then they seem to be very, you know, anti-electric cars and things like that. And, you know, they got legislation that blocks those sorts of things. And so, you know, yeah, and that's because, you know, you've got a legislature that has the mentality that, you know, they believe in fossil fuels and they don't want to do anything to, you know, slow that down, or, you know, maybe some of their best donors happen to be in that industry. And it all kind of fits together, you know, and the bottom line is, I don't think that our government officials have done much at all to, you know, try and, you know, keep us healthy from this bad air.
Emma, what do state regulators say from the Division of Environmental Quality or the Division of Air Quality say about, or have they had a chance to sort of look over this new research, or did you get comment from them on this, I guess?
Not on this particular study, but they have been working on a state implementation plan is what it's called, because of the situation with particulates and the inversion here in Utah. The EPA requires Utah to put together a plan, or in this case, a new plan. They had a previous plan that didn't work out. And so they have to put together this new plan for how they're going to address this pollution and bring it back down to acceptable levels, you know, per the EPA's standards. And they've been trying to, you know, they have computer models and different kinds of things that they use to try to determine, you know, if we did this or if we did that, what would happen? Could we eliminate the pollution this way? And they've really been struggling over the last year. They have been unable to come up with a strategy that, according to their own computer models, will meet the EPA's standards by the 2019 deadline that this plan is supposed to show that they'll meet.
You know, meanwhile, you have people like State Senator Todd Weiler, who in a tweet says we've got better air quality than we've ever had before, which, you know, if you look back to the days of coal burning, is probably true.
Well, yes.
Okay. Yeah. You know, I'm trying to imagine, just going back to the researcher on this study who said we need to be working towards eliminating particulate pollution altogether. I'm trying to imagine what that would look like. It feels like a kind of sci-fi thought experiment, but Emma, can we even talk about that? Do we revert to horse-drawn carriages? Would a ban on internal combustion engines do the trick? What do we do?
This gets into the complexity of Utah's situation. If we reverted to horse-drawn carriages, horses produce some of the same chemicals that then you know, contribute to the formation of particulate pollution here in Utah. So, I mean, I don't have one of those computer models that I can access to see how that would work out, but I don't think it's quite so simple.
Here's a thought. How about letting Tesla sell cars in Utah?
Well, and or finding ways to dream big. I don't know. Brian Maffley, yeah. Do you want to comment on this
as
well?
Sure. Make sure you tax the electric vehicles to make sure they're paying their fair share, right?
Right.
You know, there are no easy solutions to the air quality issues, and we can't just eliminate the internal combustion engine overnight. We've built billions of dollars worth of infrastructure for internal combustion engines, and people need to get around. We've built our cities in such a way that people drive Emma long distances to and from work. Sorry, I don't want to pick on my colleague here. It's such a tough question. The thing about Todd Weiler's statement, yeah, we have in the Salt Lake Valley, some days we have exquisite air quality, but many days it's not nice. It's really bad. And this idea that because it's better than it was during the coal burning era, let's ease off. That's a dangerous position, I think, if you're wanting, or it's not helpful to solving this problem. We need to look at a lot of different ways of reducing the amount of driving people do. That's the DEQ has been very clear about that. The use of automobiles is probably the number one issue. And if we can drive cars that don't emit as much, that would be an awesome step toward reducing air quality. However, there does seem to be some hostility in the state toward giving the drivers of electric and alternative fuel vehicles a break. So some people think they ought to be subsidized, but not President Niederhauser, for example. It sounds like he wants to make sure those folks are paying their fair share.
Okay. Yeah. As we talked about for taxes, yeah, Emma, go ahead.
It's also worth noting in this discussion of, well, is the air quality better or worse than it used to be? That part of what has changed is our understanding of how air pollution affects the human body. And that's what this study, both from Harvard, and there were two other studies which were conducted locally as well, what they're driving at. You know, in the coal-burning era, when, you know, we started to discover that air pollution was bad, what we realized was it was bad for our lungs. It made it hard to breathe. It caused asthma or exacerbated asthma and caused a host of respiratory problems. But what we're discovering increasingly is that it actually affects other parts of the body. The reason that this population, age 65 and older, is vulnerable to death as a result of exposure to pollution is because it increases the likelihood of heart attack and stroke. Mm-hmm. So we're understanding that this is a more complex issue than as straightforward as we once thought it was.
I'm sorry to make you do this, but can you explain how it increases that risk?
That is something scientists are still trying to understand. The fact that something like heart attack and air pollution are tied to each other is a reasonably or relatively new finding. Not relatively new in terms of months, but in terms of years. The theory that I talked to one researcher about was that it could have to do with inflammation, that you get these particulates in, you know, your body and your bloodstream, and it causes, you know, inflammation, swelling throughout the body, and that this could exacerbate people's issues if they already have, like, heart disease that are already contributing to inflammation issues, that it could then trigger a heart attack. But this is still kind of all theoretical. We don't entirely understand. We just know that there's a correlation.
Yeah. Well, Emma, I was just going to ask, is there an autoimmune angle to some of these issues that air pollution might exacerbate?
I don't know about autoimmune. I know an Intermountain study, one of the ones that was featured in the article, pointed out that blood type had something to do with it. Mm-hmm. People with an O-type blood had a significantly lower risk of experiencing a heart attack when the pollution was elevated compared to people with other blood types.
Yeah.
So there's probably, you know, some kind of a relationship between, you know, genetic factors, lifestyle factors. People who, you know, have heart disease as a result of an unhealthy lifestyle are more susceptible to death as a result of pollution. And there's also, you know, the environment that you're in, the amount of pollution you're exposed to. These things are probably all working together.
Early days yet, but are there any signs that the legislature during the session is going to do more on air quality? It seems like, given this data and the fact that it's causing deaths, that we know that it's causing deaths, there's more evidence showing that it's causing deaths, that you would think there might be more of a mandate to try and address it. Emma, I don't know if that's the case.
Well, I guess that's up to the lawmakers to decide whether this is a mandate for action or not. There have been some measures that have been proposed, I understand. There's more talk of we need to do something about diesel emissions. There are some counties that in Utah that require emissions testing on diesel vehicles, and there are some that don't. There's been a push in the past to try to, you know, pass a state law that requires emissions testing for all diesel vehicles to close those loopholes, and that push is coming back. And there's a couple of other measures as well that, you know, we'll see where they go.
I just wonder, I'm just thinking about people like Paul Raleigh, who are in the vulnerable group that Emma Penrod describes from this research. Those measures seem they seem important, but piecemeal, and that long term you're still going to have the same air quality pollution or problems that will affect people in your age range, Paul. I don't know. What do you make of it?
Well, I just suggest everybody move down to Torrey. But
the air quality problem.
You know,
with
I mean, it. I said it before. I believe that our legislature in our government has been slow to act, and you know, maybe you can't eliminate it altogether. But anyway, that's maybe we need to elect a new legislature.
Brian Maffley, do you want to weigh in on how radical we can get, or how possibly radical we can get in making changes?
in our state, in our legislature, I think it'll be piecemeal. It'll be improving the quality of the gasolines we sell here. But I just don't see really the kind of strong measures that you know are pursued in states like California. That would ever come to fruition here. I just don't.
Emma Penrod, yeah.
Well, it may be worth noting, too, that I've asked, you know, some state scientists what they think needs to be done. You know, do they think that, you know, this measure or that measure would be more helpful? And they have indicated that what they really need is more funding for research. Hmm. Because, again, of this issue of they aren't really quite sure what strategy would be the best way to address our situation here in Utah because it's not well understood. They really feel that the solution that they need, at least from their perspective, is that they need more money to try to better understand what's happening.
Okay. Meanwhile, there's this pretty startling new research that is interesting to check out. You can find it at sltrib.com. We are going to head to another pause here, and when we return, we will be looking at a proposal to take the regulatory authority to protect watersheds for drinking water away from cities like Salt Lake City. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more of our in-house podcasts, visit kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined in studio by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley, Emma Penrod, Lee Davidson, and Paul Raleigh. It is our Friday morning wrap-up of the week's top news. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. And Brian Maffley, we will go to a story that you covered this week. It's that Representative Mike Noel, a Republican from Kanab, he has filed a bill, House Bill 135, that would ultimately change how watersheds are overseen. Maybe we can first talk about how the mountain watersheds for places like Salt Lake City are currently regulated. The water that many of us along the Wasatch Front drink comes from the canyons to our east.
Yeah, well, that's pretty common all over the state is our communities get their water from the mountainous areas nearby. And so going back to even before statehood, the founding fathers of Utah kind of recognized that where these communities get their water needs to be protected. And so this idea that's now called extraterritorial jurisdiction. It's really painful to say that.
Yeah.
Came about, and it has kind of empowered cities, Salt Lake City in particular, to govern what happens in these places very far outside their boundaries. And it over the years, Salt Lake City has become a very important provider of water, not just to the residents of Salt Lake City, but the people who work here during the day. The population of the city basically doubles, and then also a number of communities along the eastern bench of the valley, Cottonwood Heights almost all the way into Sandy, for example. And so this water needs to be arrive in a pure form. So the city has adopted ordinances that prevent certain type of activities and dogs and grazing or whatever from fouling the water from the in the mountains
in the canyons. The control that Salt Lake City has that it's wielded over the canyons isn't to the liking of some property owners inside of the canyons, and that's essentially where this is coming from. Maybe we can jump to the next step of this.
Yeah, and these rules have become a problem for folks who own property in Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon, and there's a long history of conflict and court stuff going on between, particularly in Albion Basin, Little Cottonwood Canyon, and Cardiff Fork and Big Cottonwood Canyon. There's property owners there that understandably would like to build on their land and enjoy this beautiful mountain setting. And they feel that the city is preventing them from doing that.
So, and that's the concern that Mike Noel's bill is trying to address. What would it do? What would this bill do, Brian?
Well, it looks to me like it repeals the idea that the doctrine of extraterritorial jurisdiction. So it doesn't just apply to Salt Lake City, but any city that has a regulatory authority over land outside its boundaries and gives it to the Department of Environmental Quality, who will, you know, enact and enforce the ordinances along with the local health departments to make sure the water sources are protected.
Does DEQ want that responsibility, I guess?
Well, I haven't talked to Director Matheson yet, but there was a meeting at the Executive Water Task Force this week that was really eye-opening. And Mike Noel, the sponsor of the bill, didn't show up at this meeting, but this topic dominated the people who attended, especially members of the Department of Environmental Quality. And it sure seemed like the Division of Water Quality did not feel like they're in a good position and well suited to take on this task.
So this, I mean, does that mean that Representative Noel didn't exactly reach out to DEQ before trying to?
It sounds like he didn't. This idea that the bill attacks extraterritorial jurisdiction has come up from time to time in the Commission for the Stewardship of Public Lands, and at a very obscure thing called the Quality Growth Commission. They were asked. It's a legislatively kind of appointed body, and they were asked to review this issue, and they spent some time with it and came back and said, we just don't have the expertise to offer any recommendations. And so it really hasn't gotten the review that it deserves before coming forward with a bill like this. It's really viewed as kind of draconian, and, you know, it really rewrites a big piece of Utah's water policy. And I should point out that it's kind of being packaged with a couple other bills as well we might want to talk about later in the segment.
Sure. Also, Brian, in just something that occurs to me is that in December there was a report in the Tribune, I think by Jennifer Dobner, about the self-determination desires of some residents up Big Cottonwood Canyon in Brighton. Does this play into? I mean, does what Mike Noel is doing play into their desire to become a town?
Well, that's an interesting question. So, what Jennifer's story was about was the residents of Upper Big Cottonwood Canyon want to incorporate to give them some self-determination. Right now, that's unincorporated Salt Lake City County, and the county makes all the decisions for them. But a lot of the land inside this proposed city is within Salt Lake City's watershed. I don't know. I don't know if there is what the tie-in here is.
I want to bring Paul Raleigh, opinion columnist, in on this. Paul, Representative Mike Noel is he's from Kanab, and I'm wondering, maybe this is actually a question for Brian, what his motivation is, because aren't the lands affected?
Let me answer that.
Okay, go ahead. Paul Raleigh, go ahead.
I've got some feelings
from
about
the columnist's hat.
I'm going to put it this way. Years ago, when Rocky Anderson was mayor of Salt Lake City, he was a very liberal guy, you know, in this little liberal island of Salt Lake City, and he was the bane of Republicans throughout the state. And there was actually a movement. I mean, I don't know how seriously it ever got, because it had all sorts of legal and constitutional problems, so it might have never been realistic. But there was a very vocal movement from people in Davis County and people out in, like, West Jordan and South Jordan and some of the more conservative areas of the county, where they felt that they should be allowed to vote for the Salt Lake City mayor because they worked in Salt Lake City, they shopped in Salt Lake City, and so they should have a voice in Salt Lake City. And it was a pretty big deal at the time, even though it was really never realistic. I would like to propose that people in Salt Lake County should get to vote in the Kane County legislative race, because Mike Noel constantly tries to interject his will, you know, that affects us up here, affects our air quality, affects everything else. I remember a few years ago, he you know, he had this bill to allow for like wood burning ovens and all this stuff in Salt Lake County and Salt Lake City. And I mean, you know, if he's going to keep, you know, messing around with our quality of life up here and our local government's ability to regulate our water quality and everything else, I think we should get to vote in the legislative race. I mean, he's always going around trying to mess around with other people's communities. Tory had this, they've got this serious water problem down there.
Right.
They wanted to use some state, impact, local government impact money to increase their water quality. Well, he represents Tory. I mean, he's their representative in the legislature. And he was fighting against that because he was mad because a lot of people in Tory didn't want a gravel pit down there where there's a great, dark sky area in Capitol Reef National Park. And I think that we ought to be able to have a say in, this guy seems to think, he represents these sparsely populated areas down in southern Utah, but yet he seems to think that he gets to run, the entire state and affect us.
I want to hear listeners' comments on this. Do you think we should be allowed to vote? Those of you in the Salt Lake Valley, should we be allowed to vote in Kane County? I'm kidding. But call us with your questions and comments, 801-355-8255. Brian Maffley, going back to you, the argument from property owners that are up the canyon, and I guess that Noel is concerned about, is that individual property rights are being trampled. The argument from the municipalities downstream is that essentially the good of the many, downstream outweighs those rights.
Well, Salt Lake City has said, look, we have a system now that has worked well for the entire valley, not just Salt Lake City, for a century. Why mess with it? Why not? Let's have a discussion and figure out how we can make it work more efficiently for everybody. The fact is, when people bought property up in Cardiff Fork, you kind of went with these restrictions. Property, back in the 60s or 70s, this property probably wasn't worth much. Now it's worth, if you can build on it, literally millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So it's become, maybe that's what's driving this. And I think a lot of these property owners would just as soon be bought out. Their property has been rendered worthless because they can't build on it. And so they're feeling kind of burned.
Buying them out was a proposal that was made by this Quality Growth Commission you mentioned before, or that was sort of suggested, I guess.
They suggested maybe we could resolve these issues through, through offering financial relief to some of these people. But at this point, it would be extremely costly.
Mm. Yeah. What does Salt Lake City say about this proposal?
I spoke to the director of public utilities about it the other morning. We'll be reporting on that some more. They were pretty concerned. They felt that the DEQ is, they're not, that agency's not immediately accountable to the ratepayers and the water users in Salt Lake City. They are accountable to the state as a whole. And that the water provider should be the one to kind of, be tasked with this responsibility of passing rules to, make sure the water doesn't get polluted. So, Salt Lake City, not only, they want to protect the water at its source and then at the treatment stage and at the distribution stage and all along. And it should be a, according to their view, that it should be a single entity that kind of oversees that from the source to the user.
Hmm. Not with without any trade in authority as you make your way down the canyon. I can't leave this conversation without mentioning a couple of sort of bizarre provisions that are in this bill that have to do with grazing and with driving stock through towns, well, through cities, actually. Bizarre because of where this would apply, Brian.
Yeah, so there's this provision at the end of the bill that no one can understand, and I haven't been able to talk to Mike Noel about it, but it requires the cities of the first class, which are those whose populations exceed 100,000, there's five or six of them in the state, and they're all on the Wasatch Front, will be required to kind of designate a highway through the town that livestock can use to run livestock through, and specifically, what was it, cattle, horses,
hogs
yeah. and sheep.
As right. if
and,
we didn't have a traffic jam problem already.
Yeah,
right?
And the thing is, it's like, well, there's in this day and age, there's not a whole lot of livestock grazing on the periphery of our big cities. Maybe in 1907, which is the year this year, Roger did his own research here and found this verbatim provision in some 100-year-old statute, Utah statute, which I think, you know, I think those statutes probably reflect an era when livestock was king, with a very important industry in the state. And of course, it still is. And culturally, it has a great deal of significance. And I think maybe Mike Noel is just trying to assert the importance of livestock grazing to our state. And let's be frank here. I mean, the guy is a rancher himself, right. and he is also the manager of a water district down in Kane County. So, you know, he's in a good position to have a stake here.
I guess I'm wondering, does that mean that he's setting precedent, you know, in these cities of the first class up here in Salt Lake City and along the Wasatch Front, so that in the future the district that he represents can sort of follow suit?
Yeah. So when Kanab becomes a first class city, I guess we can make sure that there's a or St. George, for that matter, there'll be ways to run cattle through town. It just seems strange when you've thrown such a provision into a bill that's already very controversial and kind of complicated, and then throw this kind of curveball into it. I don't understand why you would complicate your bill that way.
Okay. Well, it's been filed. It'll have to get a hearing, and then we'll see. We'll see if and when it does get a hearing, starting in 10 days' time when the legislature.
Sure. And there's two other bills that were filed around the same time, also one by Mike Noel, that would prohibit governmental entities from advocating for federal land designations, and that seems to be targeting Salt Lake City because of its interest in the Mountain Accord outcome, which does call for further federal land designations up in the Wasatch,
right.
And that this bill would prevent the city from advocating for. That means lobbying right. members of Congress. And then a third bill is by right. Representative Coleman that concerns transparency over what are known as surplus water contracts. And those are the arrangements water providers like Salt Lake City have with new developments that will allow them to provide water to those residents, but they're not guaranteed. They're only promising to make that water available if they have sufficient quantities. You got to meet your original obligations first. And so Representative Coleman's concern is we don't really know, we have a good handle on how exposed some of these, this new development is toward running out of water. Hmm. And we'd like to generate some data to kind of get a better handle on that.
Okay. Brian, I'm sorry we're going to have to leave it at that just because we're out of time. And we'll have to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And I don't know if you want to continue on that track. You had other stories that you covered. There was Governor Herbert in D.C. On the Bears Ears National Monument speaking in favor of changes there. What's your pick for underplayed stories,
Brian? My pick for underplayed stories are these historic paintings that Logan School District wants to sell that they've had since the 30s. Many of them are acquired with students' lunch money. And Alan Weiss told me there are 36 other collections out there in the state, historic painting collections that are owned by school districts. And there seems to be this trove of Utah art that is sitting in storage in places.
We need a lunch money museum maybe to display it all.
It's a great idea.
I like it. Paul Raleigh, let's go to you for your pick for underplayed story.
Well, my underplayed story is that a little later this month, in just a couple of weeks, the Outdoor Retailers Association is going to have their winter convention. And the reason this is significant for us is for the first time in memory, it's not going to be in Salt Lake City.
Right.
It's going to be in Denver, Colorado, which means Denver, Colorado is going to get all that money from all those conventions.
It'll be a bit quieter here than it has been for quite a while during that 2-week stretch.
Right.
Emma Penrod, your pick for underplayed story.
So this was something that came out this week. The state of Utah wants a local radioactive waste handler, Energy Solutions, to pay them $50,000 in fines for violating their permit and not applying a special chemical they're supposed to use to control dust at their site in Tooele County. Now, the interesting thing about this is Energy Solutions reported these problems when they discovered them. A new manager on the job discovered that they hadn't been done properly in 2015.
Okay, and so the fine is coming years later, or is it that violation continued from 2015 onward?
The fine is coming years after the violation, which everyone agrees has been dealt with.
Okay, great. Lee Davidson, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Well, voters in southeast Salt Lake County apparently really want doctors to cure Utah's political ills. Senator Brian Shiazawa recently resigned. He's a medical doctor. He became regional director of the Health and Human Services Department in Denver. GOP delegates this week elected Brian Zender as his replacement, who is another doctor. And Kathy Allen, yet another doctor, has filed as Democrat to run against him in November. So
it's all doctors.
Right.
Doctor, doctor, doctor. Okay, Lee Davidson's pick for Underplayed Story. I'm going to go with something else that we didn't actually cover here on the show. In response to the president's now pretty much infamous reported remarks referencing the countries of Haiti and El Salvador and African nations, our country's only Haitian-American congressional representative called the president's comments unkind, divisive, and elitist. This is Republican Representative Mia Love. She issued a statement saying that the comments fly in the face of our nation's values and called the behavior unacceptable from the leader of our nation. Mia Love, of course, is the daughter of Haitian immigrants to the United States. Lee Davidson, Emma Penrod, Brian Maffley, and Paul Raleigh, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That wraps up another edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or through your podcast app. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll see you again next week.